This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Neal Conan is away this week. What's the name of the document that starts with, "We the People"? If you guess the Declaration of Independence, you're wrong. Those are the opening words of the Constitution, a document that Linda Monk calls an ongoing conversation. Linda Monk is a constitutional scholar and the author of The Words We Live By, Your Annotated Guide to the Constitution, and she's also our guest today. The Constitution created a loose framework for 13 states to form a more perfect union. Those articles and the amendments that followed contained the ideas that helped define who we are as a people and as a nation. When beliefs are tested or when our motives are questioned, knowing the words we live by can only help us understand who we are. But few of us keep a copy of the Constitution handy up there on the bookshelf beside the dictionary and the thesaurus, and few of us have bothered to read it since we left school. So how well do you know the Constitution? Do you have a favorite section, one that inspires you, one that you treasure the most? Do you ever think about how the Constitution shapes your daily life? Does it make you feel American? And have you ever seen the original? Give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Linda Monk, welcome to Studio 3A. It's good to have you.
Thanks, Lynn.
And let me start out by asking you one of those questions. What part of the Constitution is your favorite?
Well, my favorite part of the Constitution is the first three words, "We the People." And those three words, I think, comprise the greatest strength of our Constitution and the greatest weakness. Those first three words, "We the People," establish that the people are the sovereign, that principle of popular sovereignty. That was a revolutionary idea in 1787, and it's still an important idea today. But then it's also our greatest weakness, because "We the People" in 1787 did not include women, did not include African Americans, slave or free, did not even include white men who didn't own property. And so it's been through the amendment process that more and more people have been included in "We the People."
And you call the Constitution an ongoing conversation. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that the principles in the Constitution didn't magically appear in 1787 in the Philadelphia Convention where it was written. For about at least 150 years before that, Americans were debating what liberty meant. You had the slaves of Massachusetts in 1777 quoting the Declaration of Independence, saying, "We have an unalienable right to freedom." They were part of that dialogue of liberty, and it's continued since 1787.
Well, we tend to think of the Constitution as that it was a very successful document right off the bat, but actually it wasn't the first attempt, really, was it?
The Constitution that we revere today, or we respect today, was actually our second Constitution, not the first. The first was the Articles of Confederation, written in 1777, ratified in 1781, and it created kind of a loose league of friendship amongst the states, but not really a national government. For that, we needed our current Constitution.
So how did it come about?
Well, how it came about was that the states were fighting amongst themselves, kind of like jealous siblings. They couldn't handle international relations. They couldn't handle commerce. They were fighting, and George Washington himself said, kind of in frustration after he'd won the Revolution, he said, "What a triumph for our enemies to find that we are incapable of governing ourselves." And so he was one of the prime movers to create a new constitution, not just try and fix the old one.
Who's the author of those words, "We the People"?
Well, "We the People" actually was in one of the early drafts of the Constitution, but originally said, "We the people of the states of New Hampshire, New York," and listed those 13. It became "We the People of the United States" when there was a good editor named Gouverneur Morris who thought it sounded better for us to be one country.
And what about the separation of powers? I think that's a part of the Constitution that I kind of cherish and think is fascinating.
Well, you and the President and the Congress and the Supreme Court. I mean, separation of powers creates those three branches
right.
of government. The idea is that you don't want any one part of government to have too much power. That idea had originated with the philosopher Montesquieu in France, but really we were the first ones to put it into practice as a national government. John Adams included that same principle in the Massachusetts State Constitution. He thought that really was the essence of liberty.
And so when it was first tried out in Massachusetts, what did they discover?
Well, Massachusetts actually is the oldest constitution still in effect as a state or a nation. Ours is the oldest constitution as a nation still in effect.
Do you think that most Americans really are familiar with the document?
No, I don't think we are. I think that we are taught certain kind of basic principles, but, you know, the Constitution, some parts of it are like a laundry list. They aren't very interesting to read. Article 1, which creates the Congress, you know, has the powers of taxation and representation. That's not very interesting to a lot of people. But, you know, if I were most Americans, I would just start with the preamble. Those first words, I think, say it all in terms of what our government is set up to do.
All right, well, joining us now to tell us about what part of the Constitution he cherishes most and why is Nat Hentoff. He's a columnist for The Village Voice and The Washington Times, and he's also the author of Living the Bill of Rights, How to Be an Authentic American. He's working on a book right now called The War on the Bill of Rights and the Rising Resistance. He joins us from his office in New York City. Thanks for being with us, Mr. Hentoff.
Well, thank you, and thank Linda Monk. I think that book of hers should be subsidized by some philanthropist and put into every school in the nation, and more specifically now into every member of Congress can read it. We've never needed an understanding of the Constitution more now that John Ashcroft, the Attorney General, is beginning to revise it radically.
What is your favorite part of the Constitution, Mr. Hendo?
Well, it's the same one I once asked Justice William Brennan, and he, along with William O. Douglas and Thurgood Marshall, was among the most fervent defenders of the Constitution in the Supreme Court. And he said, and I agree, that I asked him, what's your favorite part? He said, the First Amendment, and my favorite part of that is Congress shall make no law prohibiting or abridging the freedom of speech. And you were saying before, to what extent do people understand the Constitution in this country? Very little. I spend a lot of time, since I run an education, in schools, from middle school through graduate schools, and most Americans are taught this very badly. I'll give you an example, a current example. There's a young woman who plays basketball in this New York area from Manhattanville College. Whenever the game is about to begin, and they play the national anthem and display the flag, she turns her back on the flag. She believes that liberty and justice for all is not yet the case in this country. As a result, there has been a furor. At the game, for example, somebody rushed onto the basketball floor, unfurled a huge flag in front of her, like a cross in front of Dracula. Then the next day at the Manhattanville campus, flags were all over the place. And that indicates very clearly that she knows the Constitution, she knows the First Amendment, because, as Linda can tell you, there has been a number of federal court cases saying that students are not required to give a Pledge of Allegiance, because out of conscience, out of their right to free speech, which also means freedom of conscience, as Americans, they can refuse to pledge allegiance. And I wonder how many teachers in this country now, when patriotism understandably is in the ascendant, how many teachers would use this as a teaching moment and talk to their classes about why this young woman did this? What does the Constitution say? What are the relevant cases? My guess is that a number of teachers would be afraid to discuss this now because many school boards would be very angry if that were brought into class.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Mr. Hentoff.
Thank you.
And thanks for that plug, Mr. Hentoff.
Nat Hentoff is a columnist for The Village Voice and The Washington Times. He's also the author of Living the Bill of Rights. We're talking about the Constitution today on Talk of the Nation. The number is 1-800-989-8255. You can email us at totn@npr.org. And let's take a call from Doug in New York City. Hi, Doug.
Oh, thank you very much. Hi.
Hi, Doug.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, since you're specifically asking for the favorite part, I was going to say the First Amendment, which is not in the original Constitution, but was forced in later by mostly by Jefferson, who was not at the Constitutional Convention.
That's right.
And through Madison, who was, of course, in the leader of the convention. But I wanted to say I've read quite a few books about the writing of the Constitution, and you know what people don't understand is how much intense disagreement there was in writing this document, and how compromised, and really how what a hodgepodge, an incomplete, totally incomplete document it was, and was really highly, highly criticized.
Oh, absolutely. It was definitely criticized at the time, and there was a real question about whether or not it was going to be ratified, as you know.
Right, and exactly. And actually, according to one historian, in 1913, the economic interpretation of the Constitution, Charles Beard,
right.
Right, he said that actually, pretty much in that book, he says that the ratification process was a cheat, that actually people mostly in most states voted for their representatives to not ratify it, and they turned around and didn't represent that at these special conventions in each state and ratified it anyway.
Well, I know that he felt strongly that the people that supported the Constitution had strong financial motives to
right.
do that.
Right.
And that was one of his criticisms, that the Constitution protects property owners too much.
Right. I just want to put in one thing. I think the most obvious, huge criticism of the Constitution as it was originally written, which we still have in place, is obviously in Article 2 of how we choose our presidents, the Electoral College, and that there is no right to actual suffrage, to actual voting process for the presidency. That's just an accident of state laws. If a state wanted to take away the right to vote for a president, it actually would be it would actually be legal to do so, according to the U.S. Constitution.
Doug, are you a lawyer or a teacher?
No,
I'm just curious.
I'm not.
You seem to know a lot about the Constitution more than most people, I think.
I take it, I guess it's a hobby.
The Constitution is a hobby for
well,
you?
Well, I've read this stuff, and you can see it right there in Article 2.
It's there right you there. Go. You're living up to your mission as citizen. I'm proud of you, Doug.
Well, we have a fraud in our election process. Even for presidents I like, they're actually not technically elected by the people.
All right,
you're
thanks so much
right.
for your call, Doug. It was great talking
thanks.
To you. Okay. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
Well, he's absolutely right that Article 2 does not establish a right of the people to select the president. It establishes the right of the state legislatures to choose electors who then they vote for president. And one interesting part of history is the founders never thought really that the Electoral College was going to choose the president. They thought of it more as a nominating process, the way we would think of political conventions today. They thought every election was going to wind up in the House of Representatives, and it was the House of Representatives that actually was going to vote for president.
So what would they have thought about our last presidential election?
Well, I think they would have been surprised that as many people as voted have voted, because certainly when they set up the Constitution, they had no idea that popular elections would be what would choose the president.
Linda, I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more. Doug was talking about the real controversy that went into shaping this document at the time, the history of it. Maybe you can expand on that just a little bit.
Right. Well, at the time in Philadelphia, there was a convention called to, at that point, amend the Articles of Confederation. They pretty soon figured out they couldn't amend it. They were going to have to come up with a new document. There were lots of debates. The longest debate actually was about creating the president, because no independent executive like that had existed before. The Supreme Court, they didn't really give much thought to. Congress, they had before. So the other debate was, of course, over slavery, about the slave trade, and also how you were going to have representation using slaves as persons. Remember that slaves were counted as three-fifths of a person. Now, women and children who also didn't vote were full persons. We often think that that means that slaves are somehow less, but in reality, that was denying southern states more power. If slaves had been full persons, that the southern states would have had more power.
This is a really interesting thing to talk about, and we're going to continue it after a short break. We are talking about the words we live by. That's the U.S. Constitution and how it defines who we are as a nation and as a people. What's your favorite part of the Constitution? Which part do you identify most that makes you feel most American? We're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. And still with us is Linda Monk. She's the author of The Words We Live By. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Later this hour, we'll remember the host of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Fred Rogers died overnight of cancer. Email us with your favorite Mr. Rogers moment. But first, we'll continue our conversation about the Constitution, not just as the law of the land, but as an ongoing conversation. Our guest is Linda Monk, author of The Words We Live By, Your Annotated Guide to the Constitution. What part of the Constitution means most to you, and have you ever seen the document? You're invited to join the discussion, give us a call at 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's go to David in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Hi, David.
Yes.
Go ahead, David.
Oh, well, I'm very amazed that the Constitution even came this far. I mean, when they were writing the Constitution, the writers, they were quarreling over almost everything. Who would get the advantage? Who would do what? Who would do this? I think that we came extremely close to not even having an America.
You're absolutely right, David. Can I ask how old you are?
I'm 11.
How'd you get that to be that smart at 11, I tell you? But you're exactly right, and I think most citizens don't have that insight that you have, that we came very close to not having a government at all. And certainly our Constitution, when it first came out, people didn't always think it was a good idea. There was a big debate over whether it should be ratified, and finally it was.
David, how much do you learn about, how much are you taught about the Constitution in school? You do seem to know a lot about it. Is that through school, or have you done some of this studying on your own?
Oh, well, this was just stuff I learned in school.
Are you interested in learning more about the Constitution, and how are you proceeding with that interest?
Well, I wouldn't say I'm extremely interested, but...
a little bit.
But yeah, I am.
Okay. Do you have a favorite part of the Constitution yet, or you still have to think about that a bit?
It would definitely have to be, like, the 13th, the 14th, and the 15th Amendment.
All right.
Because it really opened up for the African Americans.
Absolutely, and all Americans too, David. As you probably know, Justice Thurgood Marshall said that the 14th Amendment, which says that everybody is entitled to equal protection of the laws, that means unreasonable discrimination can't be allowed. Justice Marshall said that that created a whole new constitution, those amendments that got rid of slavery, gave us equal protection of the laws, and gave black men the vote in the 15th Amendment. I would add the 19th Amendment that gave women the vote in 1920.
Okay. Right. Thanks so much for your call, David.
Yes, thanks. It's an honor to be on this show.
Okay, thank you. Well, joining us now is someone who knows a bit about the 14th Amendment, and that's Linda Chavez. She's the president of the Center for Equal Opportunity, and she's joining us by phone from Reston, Virginia. Welcome to the show, Ms. Chavez.
It's great to be with you.
How has this amendment affected you personally?
Well, I have built a career promoting the idea of colorblind equal opportunity, and I believe that that is, in fact, protected by the Constitution of the United States and the 14th Amendment. So the 14th Amendment to the Constitution has been very important to me, and I think to the country, in promoting an ideal of a society in which each of us is treated, at least by the government, as equals and are not discriminated against on the basis of the color of our skin.
What are some of the big issues that the nation is facing right now where the 14th Amendment comes into play?
Well, we have a very important case that is before the Supreme Court right now involving an affirmative action program at the University of Michigan, both at the undergraduate school and also at the law school. And one of the issues in the case is whether or not the 14th Amendment to the Constitution prohibits the kind of racial preference scheme that the University of Michigan had in place, and it was challenged by a group of students who applied to the school and were rejected despite having higher grades and test scores than some of the students who were admitted under this racial preference affirmative action program.
And, of course, this gets to what we're talking about here today with regard to the Constitution, that it's a living document, an ongoing conversation, and so much about how interpretation.
Well, that's exactly right. And in fact, the 14th Amendment of the Constitution doesn't say anything about race. It does say that all persons shall be granted equal protection of the laws, but that has been interpreted to mean that the state cannot discriminate against persons because of the color of their skin. And, of course, part of it is based on the historical context of the passage of the 14th Amendment, which was passed in the wake of of the Civil War, when a whole group of Americans were suddenly enfranchised, given their freedom, given the right to vote, and made citizens of the United States. And of course, that were was African Americans in the wake of the Civil War.
All right, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Linda Chavez is president of the Center for Equal Opportunity. She joined us by phone from Reston, Virginia. I'm going to ask you if you could go over, since this is the annotated guide, and
right.
we're assuming that perhaps many people are not as familiar with the Constitution as we would hope. So far, we've been hearing about the First Amendment, the 14th Amendment. Let's talk about the amendments to the Constitution.
Okay.
What are the amendments to the Constitution?
Well, let's start with the first 10. The first 10 amendments are commonly known as the Bill of Rights. They were added to the Constitution in 1791. In fact, that was the big reason most people opposed the original Constitution in 1787. It did not have a Bill of Rights. Most of the Federalists, including James Madison, George Washington, didn't think they were necessary. But the people in all the different states said, we're not going to ratify this Constitution without a Bill of Rights. James Madison in the first Congress proposed them, basing it on the constitutions of a lot of different states. Then after those amendments, you have the 11th Amendment, which has to do with lawsuits against the state, the 12th, which changed the procedures for voting. Then you skip to the Civil War. That's when you have freedom for former slaves. You have equal protection of the law and the vote. And then most amendments after the 15th Amendment have to do with voting, whether it's for women in the 19th Amendment, young people in the 26th, ending the poll tax, or giving people in the District of Columbia the right to vote in presidential elections.
Okay. The Constitution is the talk of the nation. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Gail in Martinsville, Virginia. Hi, Gail.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, go ahead.
The preamble is my favorite, probably my most favorite part of the Constitution. But
you and me too, Gail. I think we should be reciting the preamble every chance we get.
Yeah, me too. In high school, actually in grammar school and high school in Cochise County, Arizona, where I grew up and was educated, we had to study the Constitution. Actually, I had to first learn it in the sixth grade. And then in the eighth grade, in order to get out of elementary school, you had to study the Arizona State Constitution and the Federal Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to make a passing grade to get out of elementary school into high school. And then we had to do the same thing again when we were seniors. And I wouldn't take anything for that, because I guess we were all fortunate who went to school in that area, or in the state of Arizona at that time, because we had very good teachers, and in high school they really worked us over about both the state and the federal constitution.
Do you think that kids are getting taught enough about the Constitution now, or do you think that they're not being taught enough these days?
Well, I guess I would say it would depend on the quality of the information that they're getting. I think if students are taught the Constitution in the light that we want to free people's minds to think, to be responsible, and to be very proud to be an American, no matter what your position is politically, but be responsible for that position.
Well, and that's exactly the point that I try and make in my book, Gail. The reason I gave it the title, The Words We Live By, is because for the Constitution to really have meaning, it has to be the words we live by, not just the words we recite, not just the words that are under glass at the National Archives in Washington. Right. You know, one scholar has said, every morning when we wake up, we decide whether we want to live in a constitutional republic. And that's what I hope people will take from my book.
Thanks so much for your call, Gail. Joining us now is another expert on the laws of our land, Alan Dershowitz. Alan Dershowitz is a professor of law at Harvard University. He has a new book coming out about the Declaration of Independence. It's called America Declares Independence, and he joins us by phone from Boston, Massachusetts. Thanks for being on Talk of the Nation today, Mr. Dershowitz.
Well, thank you so much, and I've actually had an opportunity to peruse this book. It is excellent. It is really a first-rate book. I love the little annotations on the side, and it really brings the Constitution alive, so congratulations on
thank
a great
you,
book.
Thank you, Professor Dershowitz, and you're quoted many times. You gave me some of those wonderful, colorful stories.
Thanks.
So what part of the Constitution intrigues you the most, Professor?
Well, I love the fact that there is one word missing from the Constitution, and it's probably the most important word that has ever been left out of a Constitution, and that is God. It's the godless constitution. The word religion is mentioned only once in the constitution, and that is in a negative sense, that no religious test shall ever be required for office. It's what allowed us to become the greatest, freest, most pluralistic country in the history of the world, that we don't require religious tests. We were the first constitution ever that allowed people on an equal basis, without regard to their beliefs about religion, to be full and first-class citizens, and it's what allowed people of my religious background, Jewish, to become part of America on a first-class basis, not simply being tolerated. And although for years and years people try to put both God and Jesus into the Constitution, as recently as the 1950s there was an attempt to put Jesus in the Constitution and say that we all live under Jesus, that was rebuked repeatedly, and so we're a constitution for everybody, regardless of their views about religion.
Isn't it fascinating that, as you said, religion is mentioned only once, and yet we've had so many battles, is that the right word? Certainly controversies about religion and the Constitution over the years.
Well, of course, the First Amendment, right. Which then is not the body of the Constitution, it then, right. Of course, writes in a very, very confusing manner that we have two rights, of course, the right of free exercise of religion and the right essentially not to have religion established. And those sometimes look in somewhat different directions, and lots of litigation has been over the meaning of the First Amendment religion clause.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being with us today.
That's my pleasure.
Dershowitz.
Thank you.
Alan Dershowitz is a professor of law at Harvard University. And let's now take a call from Mike in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I'm humbled to be on the same program with Alan Dershowitz and Linda Chavez, both of whom I have great respect for. Thank you. My favorite part of the Constitution is Article 1, Section 8, which delineates the specific powers of the federal government. Unfortunately, over the years, we have paid less and less attention to it as a nation, and in the process have created the imperial federal government, which was precisely what the founding fathers feared when they created the Constitution.
Well, Mike, as you also know, you have to look at Article 1, Section 9, too, which says that the government has the powers that are necessary and proper. And as you know, that was one of the big debates of the Constitutional Convention was, on one hand, you don't want the federal government to have too much power, but you don't want it to have too little either. And I'd just like to invite our listeners out there to come to my website at lindamonk.com. I'd like to hear more of your ideas about what you think about the Constitution, what your favorite parts are, and continue this conversation of the words we live by.
May I ask one question, please?
Sure, go ahead.
Does the Constitution limit the federal government in any way? And if so, how?
Well, as you probably know, the 10th Amendment specifically says that all powers not delegated to the federal government are reserved to the states. And that's probably been the biggest debate we've had throughout American history. That is the only part of the Bill of Rights that was recommended by every state that supported a Bill of Rights, was the 10th Amendment.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Mike.
I'm sorry. I didn't understand your answer. Was the answer yes or no? Does it limit the federal government's
power? Yes. The 10th Amendment does limit the federal government's power, particularly under the current Supreme Court, which has given new life to the 10th Amendment.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks so much, Mike. Linda Monk is the author of The Words We Live By, Your Annotated Guide to the Constitution, and we are talking about the Constitution. If you'd like to join the conversation, it's 800-989-8255, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I have an email here, an interesting one that I'd like to hear you address, Linda. I think an important but often forgotten part of constitutional history is the amendment prohibiting the sale and consumption of alcohol and the later repeal of that amendment. More than any other portion, this exemplifies one of the ongoing philosophical debates within this country. Linda?
Well, she's talking about the 18th and 21st Amendments, the ones that first outlawed the consumption of alcohol and then repealed it. I think some people would say that it's an example of when we try and regulate too much through our Constitution. Some people, in fact, have said that the current war on drugs, of criminalizing the abuse of drugs, in fact, is another example like the prohibition of something that we shouldn't try and be doing.
One other question, and that is, we started this by saying that a lot of people don't know too much about the Constitution. What's the problem with people being ignorant of the Constitution?
Well, I think we have a special responsibility as citizens, because I really do believe that the hopes of the world lie with us. We're the richest nation, we're the most powerful nation, we're the oldest democracy, and if in our current circumstances we can't uphold these democratic principles, who will? Knowing the Constitution, knowing the different responsibilities of government, helping us know that there are limits to government and that we as citizens are responsible for enforcing those limits and enforcing those principles, that's the most important thing, and that we as citizens of a democracy and as the world's best hope for democracy, frankly, have that ongoing responsibility. It's up to us.
All right, let's see if we can take one more call. Dale in Rock Island, Illinois. Hi, Dale.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm a lawyer, and my favorite part of the Constitution, among others, I suppose, is the Fourth Amendment. I had a case one time where there was a blatantly illegal seizure of some things from a client, and when I filed a motion to suppress, I told the state court trial judge that I didn't want to bore him with all the new latest search and seizure cases, but that I'd read him some important words. And I proceeded to read him words about how citizens should be inviolate in their person from unreasonable searches and seizures, et cetera. And he said, yes, yes, counsel, I know all about the Fourth Amendment. And I said, well, Your Honor, these are actually taken from Articles 54, 55, and 56 from the Constitution of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics at a time when the Cold War was at its peak. And there were some gasps from the courtroom, and I said, the only difference between their flowery language and our flowery language are you, that uphold people's rights.
Okay, Linda, can you respond to that? Thanks so much for your call.
Well, as you probably know, we're celebrating the 200th anniversary of the power of judicial review in America, and you're absolutely right that what helps rights in our country are not just that they're written down on paper. Lots of countries have that, but we have a judicial branch that actually enforces those rights. But still, the most important thing is we the people. Judge Learned Hand said, liberty lies in the hearts of men and women, and when it dies there, no law, no court, no constitution can save it.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Linda Monk. Linda is the author of The Words We Live By, Your Annotated Guide to the Constitution. She joined me here in Studio 3A.